Welcome to Education Suspended, a podcast focused on exploring, engaging, and dialoguing with those in education who are passionate about changing the status quo and evolving the archaic system we have inherited.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Education Suspended. Jessica Pfeiffer here. We have reached the part of the school year that goes so incredibly fast and yet at the same time so incredibly slow. So good luck. Keep your head up. You're almost there. Hopefully today's episode brings you some joy and just honestly just reminds you of how valued you are, though you might not feel that way, and that what you do matters. So we sit down with Leilani Scott, and I've had the privilege of knowing her. Wow, I actually don't know how many years we've known each other, Leilani. We should talk about that the next time we connect, even though I just saw you. Anyway, I have had the privilege of working with Leilani and her school district in Mesa, Arizona for several years as a consultant, and just have always been inspired by her leadership and her ability to balance what she's asked to do as an administrator, how she cares for her staff, and at the same time, just does an amazing job of pushing the system forward. She has a really amazing background, which I think leads to that ability and the strengths that she has now. In full transparency, we went into this interview wanting to unpack a little bit of the ABA world that we're seeing in education and kind of bring a lens to that, try to understand a little bit of how it can fit or where it can fit, I would say. And I know it's not going to shock any of you that listen regularly, but we didn't really get there because we were having such an amazing conversation about her experience as an administrator and a teacher before that. And she really just focuses on the impact of not feeling validated. And when you don't feel empowered, of how that impacts us, and just some of the silent signals that we should really focus on with us and with our coworkers, and I mean, just the adults in general in our system. She really talks about as a leader, how she's constantly trying to propel others forward, whether it's the students, the staff that she serves, the community, like that pushing everyone forward is so vitally important. And that when you're making changes, especially ones that you want to last and sustain, that you've got to slow down to eventually speed up. And it was just a good reminder, because I know, you know, the educational system, we're constantly at a place that we're trying the next new thing. And that tends to be an area that we struggle with. The other thing that I love that she said, which I know we have all heard before, but when you hear someone share it about their own story, that mistakes are so valuable and so necessary. And if we take the time to be grateful for the mistakes that we do make, you know, we can step back and begin to understand that our biggest lessons come from our mistakes, and we can learn from them. And it's, you know, we should encourage our kids to make mistakes. And I think that's a big thing that we've kind of gotten away from. So anyway, we have a great conversation. Leilani, thanks for joining us. I really hope you all enjoy this episode. I hope you all are taking care of yourselves. Again, we're inching our way towards the summer, but slow and steady wins the race, my friends. So please take care of yourself and sit back and enjoy Education Suspended with Leilani Scott.
Have a great day at school. Stay kind and curious.
Hi, Leilani.
Hello, how are you?
Good, it's good to see you.
Likewise.
I'm super excited this is finally happening. I feel like I've been to Arizona the last 3 years, and every time I leave, I'm like, Leilani, we got to get you on the podcast. And so we're finally doing it. And you, to say you're super busy would be an understatement. So thank you for giving us your time today. So Leilani, we begin all of our episodes the same. Steve and I are going to hand it over to you. And what we're going to have you do is introduce yourself to our listeners, share with them what you do, how you got to that position. And we would love it if you'd reflect a little bit on your own experience as a student and connections to what you do now. How are those at play with one another?
Perfect.
All right. We will hand it off to you.
Nice to be here today. I'm Leilani Scott, and I am the Director of Student Support Systems in Mesa Public Schools. Mesa is the largest school district in Arizona. We have 84 schools, and we serve anywhere between 56 to 60,000 students in our district. And my department oversees all of the intensive, basically behavioral and emotional supports for the district. So we have a team of board certified behavior analysts known as BCBAs and a team of behavior specialists. These are educators who have experience with behaviors and or trauma and adverse experiences. And we receive referrals from all over the district, and they may be general ed students, they may be special ed students, and we provide support. Our job is to try to provide the student with skills, the classroom and that teacher with skills, and the schools with skills and competencies to keep those students in their least restrictive environment. If we feel that in the environment is a barrier, we have processes in place to work through that, to make sure students are placed in appropriate environments to meet their needs, whether they are general ed or special ed students. And so that's what we do day in and day out. It's really fun. We oversee all of the PBIS implementation, the trauma practices within the district, and the interconnected system framework, where we're really branching and bringing in the outside community health, behavioral health agencies into our schools and bridging that gap between the schools and the community supports. So that's what I do.
That's a lot of work. Do you want to share a little bit? Do you mind sharing a little bit about your own experience as a student?
Absolutely. So my experience as a student was many, many moons ago. And I'll try to, you know, remember back to those, you know, buggy and horse-drawn carriage days. As a learner, I was a student who struggled with my own acceptance. From the point of, I wasn't that person that fit in. I wasn't the smartest person in my class, but I wasn't, you know, the most struggling student in my class either. But I really felt like I was an invalidated student within my school community. I felt that from my earliest memories of kindergarten all the way through high school. That mentality, whether it was just something that I, you know, predisposed to myself, but it became my own reality, that I really did not ever just quite fit in. And so I tried a whole bunch of different things. You know, I was very active in music, and, you know, I thought I was going to be a music major at some point, be the first female conductor of a major symphony orchestra. I had a lot of need and a lot of externalized behaviors from a behavioral perspective, trying to gain the acceptance of my peers and from my teachers. At that same time, I was living in a family who they never said that they did not value education, but they never promoted the value of education either. I was the first person in my family to go to college. It wasn't a thing at that time, right? You don't go to college, you get married, you have babies, right? You do that. So during this whole entire process of feeling undervalued, I did a lot of things, especially like in my junior high years, those pre-adolescents, where I did a lot of things to gain the attention of my peers and try to maintain that attention from my peers, you know, and it was very inappropriate, but it worked for me at that time, right? So I had a lot of attention-seeking behavior. I'm going into high school and trying to figure out who I was and why I was and why I was or was not liked, and if that was important to me at that point in time. My heart was really drawn to those that I felt were more unwanted than me. And I remember that. And I remember thinking back then, for me, those students, special education students specifically, were students that you didn't really see a lot. They were just in those classrooms. And so moving forward into adulthood and going through college, I kept going back to that as, wow, I really felt the best when I was standing up for others that I felt were less fortunate than me. And it got me outside of my own head. And so going into music, I thought, okay, I'm just going to be a music major. And then, you know, I may go on to conduct an orchestra, but I just may teach a band or a choir. And I may just do that. And it's going to be really cool. Those were the only teachers that I had a relationship with ever in my educational career, ever. I have two teachers I can tell you by name, that the only two teachers that I thought knew me and accepted me for who I was and didn't really judge me. And so as an adult, and figuring out really where I wanted to go. And as the doors began to open, I learned that the doors I needed to step through were going to be the doors that could actually help others, and that I was really think I was meant to be on this earth to have an impact on others in some way. And I just need to figure that out. Yeah, my experience has definitely led into where I am today, but I think those experiences helped me recognize which doors that were opened for me in the journey were the doors that I was most comfortable and confident in walking through. We all go through that journey of, you know, lots of doors are going to open for us and we may recognize them, we may not. And I wanted to make sure I was walking through the right doors when they were presented. So I did. So I started teaching and I wanted to work with underserved populations. You know, I worked with ELL students. I worked as an educator in a very low income district. And then that just led to another door, to another door, to another door through general ed, to special ed, to vision, and then into administration, where I really knew that that's where I wasn't planning on going. But I knew based on my young, early experiences that I needed to be that leader that could prevent other students feeling the way I felt, undervalued, unseen, unwanted, uncared for, so that they could grow up and be the best versions of themselves. And so that's what I've been doing ever since.
It's interesting as you're talking about like this impact of feeling undervalued. I like how you said that, because I think one of the conversations, or several of the conversations that you and I have had over time, is it's not necessarily these, you know, these very explicit, these large things that the schools are doing to give the message that a student is undervalued. It's these continual silent signals that we just give. And those, I think, are the ones that are just so pervasive.
I really felt like my educational experience did not empower me. And I wanted to be empowered. When I became an adult, I knew that I wanted to have that empowerment. And if it didn't come from my family who loved me, but didn't know how to empower me in the way that I needed to be empowered, then how am I going to do that for others? So that's just been something that's been cognizant with me. And it's a decision I make. My purpose is that I'm a force for improvement and empowerment and growth in order to propel others forward and leaving their mark on the world. And I try to live that every day. And so all the work that we do now is really about that. How can we propel others forward? How can we empower others? Not only in individual improvement, but within systems, right? How can I improve systems that really support and propel others forward? So that's a huge part of my work and where I spend a great majority of my time working on how can we make systems and communities better while we have great people that are in the trenches making students better.
I was just sitting listening to you, Leilani, and I said, I was going to ask you, did you not have any teachers that saw you? I love that your words there, being seen or not seen. And then you said, well, your music teachers did. And then the other thing that balanced that was you could see other children who were somewhat unseen. So put those two things together. What was it about the music teachers? Maybe you're just more regulated in music and it made it easier. But what was it about your music teachers and about yourself? What characteristics did you need in order to see kids?
I think it was music allowed me to have that first sense of success of, oh, I can do this. This is something that I can do. I can sing on pitch, or I can read music and I can play instruments. It was really my first educational experience that I actually interpreted as success. Even though I wasn't a failing student, I felt that I was contributing in music and that I was being validated for that contribution. That, wow, okay. And that was really my first ever in my educational experience where I actually felt that type of value, that I brought something into the classroom that was meaningful, just me, putting me together in a group to make something beautiful was even more impactful for me. Because then it was like, okay, I'm feeling value, but I'm also contributing to something sounding really amazing and beautiful. But I also learned early on and was able to self-recognize that music was very much regulating to me. I definitely had some events in my childhood that impacted me personally. And so music really helped me and was almost therapeutic through that process as well. And I did truly feel most regulated when I was in those types of settings. And then that allowed me to just begin to see beyond myself. Once I truly began to feel that value, I was able to begin to recognize that value in others. And I don't think I could until then.
You were experiencing success.
Yes.
In a way that it's probably not, you know, one of the data points that most right. schools get when they think of what is successful. So I really like that because it challenges us again to continue to think about what we deem as success are oftentimes not the things that we're looking for in our kids.
Absolutely. And so often I was one of those students that didn't necessarily come to school to learn, and I didn't come to school to socialize. I came to school because I had to come to school. And so when you didn't have that community that you truly associated with, that you didn't have those peers that you hung out with, right? That you had life outside of school with. When you don't have those things, it's so developmentally necessary that you are able to connect in some way. We're all wired for connection, and we're kind of all hardwired to please too. Music for me was very much why I came to school. That's how I began to identify myself. I come to school because I'm in band and I'm in choir and I'm in orchestra. And that's why I come to school. And that kind of is where I began to form my own identity. Those types of, you know, extracurricular components play a huge role in children's lives that I think sometimes we don't, you know, truly understand or appreciate.
Were those music kids also the ones you formed the greatest attachments to?
Yes, I would say so.
I just find the great value in all of us as teachers understanding that when something is sort of results oriented as a team, I'm guessing it was not so much solo work as it was teamwork. And you said you felt you were contributing, and then that allowed you to make the step forward.
I was contributing, and I was able to see my own worth within that. And then being able to contribute to the worth of others through that, because, you know, you have to work together and you have to collaborate and you all have to, you know, do your own part. And then when you do, you make something really beautiful. And so it truly is a very strong community.
And I'm guessing that's translated into your current work.
Correct.
And I'd be curious of an example or anything like that.
Yeah. So, you know, when I first came to Mesa, I spent most of my career in Colorado. As an educator, I had gone into my leadership experience in Colorado. And then moving back to Arizona, I came into the role as a principal in a K-12 school for students with significant emotionally challenged behaviors. All these students also had disabilities. And so I was drawn to how do we take these students who I perceived as being out of sight, out of mind for a school district, because they are removed from their home schools, they're placed at this school, it's fine if they stay there until they graduate type of aspect. And how do I change that, knowing my belief about what is in the best interest for any child and what is in the best interest for any educator? And how do I, as a new person in a district, begin to have those important and crucial conversations around no child is thrown away and no child should ever be placed and dehumanized into a place to where they don't have the ability to return and be with their peers, and understanding the importance of that community. So knowing that was my big picture, then how do I create a community first within my school and be able to make sure that all students and staff feel valued? They have purpose, they can contribute, they can recognize their contribution, and then begin to spread that to other surrounding schools, returning these students back to their home schools, having those conversations with their previous teachers to say, this student can come back to you. These are the skills that the student needs. This is your part in helping the student maintain their success, and let us help you with that. So that was kind of the whole head, I think, to my whole entire journey, was walking through that door to be at that school and then making those changes there and then trying to tackle that more from a systemic level, district-wide level, community level, state level. How do we really do this? Not just for special ed students, but for all students.
Okay, I'm going to try to connect some dots because one of the things that I'd love to jump into is your work within that PBIS model, right? So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about what do we mean when we're talking about PBIS for those that might not know what that means. But thus far, you've talked about, like, here are some keywords that I've written down: valued, empowered, contribution, validating, community. How do we connect those crucial words into what really should be a successful PBIS model? And I'm throwing a lot of questions at you so we can parse it out. The other thing that I love is that you maintain your focus on the system. Rarely have I heard you say, here's what the kid needs to do, here's what the kids need to shift. It's like, no, we as the system and we as the adults need to shift. So when you say PBIS, what do you mean by that? And how do we take some of those crucial characteristics and overlap that in that system?
Great question. So PBIS is Positive Behavior Intervention and Supports, and it's a framework, a best practice, grounded in empirical evidence and research, right? And there's, you know, we can talk about George Sue Guy, who's the most famous for PBIS, Rob Horner, and what they do in their work and their research around that. But it's grounded and founded as a framework of practice. It's not something that we do to kids, and it's not even something that we do for kids. It is a way in which we work in an environment. That environment may be a school. That environment may be a hospital. That environment may be a home. But it's a way in which we perform things that we know have strong outcomes. And so with PBIS, the emphasis really is on adult behavior. And if adults do the right things, meaning adults have high expectations for students. They've taught those expectations to students. Those expectations have been taught to staff, new teachers, new IAs come on board and they're trained. The expectations actually have value. There's a need for them. They're not just fluff. Expectations reflect the community and the culture that you want your school or a district or whatever it may be to have. And it's important to allow everyone to be successful. You teach those explicitly. You reinforce those things when you see them. So it really is all about taking that proactive approach and prepping students up for success versus waiting for them to fail so that you can reprimand them. But, you know, as you know, our educational, you know, system, all the way back to when, you know, Thomas Edison was really talking about formalizing education way back when, really was, it's for some. And it's for those kids that can access it and be okay. And those kids that can't or can't meet the norms, then the system isn't for you. And so our educational system has kind of always historically revolved around that. Good kids stay in school, bad kids don't. School is about compliance. You listen to adults, you do what adults say, but that doesn't mean that you're learning the skills that you need to be successful post-school. You're just learning really good how to be compliant, but compliance isn't a skill. And so it's giving students the skills that they need to be successful. And as an outcome of that, you've got this teaching system, you've got this reinforcement system that's catching students meeting the appropriate behaviors. You may have a token economy system where you're tying in tangible reinforcement to a student who needs it. But that system really is a tangible reminder to reinforce the adult to make sure they're being cognizant of catching students meeting the expectations. And if we just do these simple things, then what's going to happen is what we know about behavioral science is that having that reinforcement and that positive aspects to things and catching students when they're doing something right, adults when they're doing something right, solidifies and helps to support and maintain those doing the right things because we're wired to please as mammals. So that's what PBIS is designed for. And outcomes of that are reduction in problem behavior, an increase in academic achievement, an increase in teacher retainment, because teachers are more happy in their jobs when they have less behaviors in their classrooms because they have more time to teach. So the universal premise of PBIS is a universal tier one perspective. Tier ones for all students, is that we have strong empirical universal practices in place. Students have access to high, you know, curriculum, right? They have all the resources and supports, and it's for every child on that campus. And by implementing this framework, we're going to be able to really catch at least 80% of those students and prevent them from failing. And when that isn't enough, then at a tier two level, we can support some students, a smaller subpopulation of students, right? That, you know, 10%, 15% of students who may need a little bit more. They need all of that universal best practice, but they also need just a little bit more in small group settings to meet their needs. As somebody who practices behaviors, I will always say you will never have a behavior that doesn't have a social deficit. They coexist together. But teachers don't know how to address social deficits, or they don't have the right resources and supports to address social deficits. And so that's what Tier 2 does for PBIS. And then it targets those students who need intensive individual support. So it really is a whole system shift.
Greener, I'm totally monopolizing this. So you just throw things at me if you want me to stop talking, because I could talk to Leilani all day, every day. I love that definition, right? That was very concrete. How in an ideal world, this thing is supposed to work. I have seen schools that say, oh yeah, well, you know, our school is rooted in PBIS. And you walk through and you're like, under no circumstance is your school rooted in PBIS.
Absolutely.
And I walk through schools that actually do it very well. More often than not, one of the common themes is, and I heard you say this, but more often than not, the system itself is kind of rooted in culturally relevant expectations and developmentally relevant expectations. The other thing that tends to these schools that do it well, and this is where I'm curious as to kind of feedback that you can give to those listening that might do this. Sometimes it just becomes all about the extrinsic reward, the carrot. And I feel like they really are missing the boat. How does that happen, right? And what are things to do to ensure that it's not about the extrinsic carrot?
And I think that's a huge misconception with PBIS. I think there's many misconceptions, but the biggest one being that there has to be that token system. There has to be the tickets have value of money. It's monetary, and then students can purchase things like that. But when you go back and you really look at the research behind the very beginning precepts of PBIS, it wasn't about that. It's about relationships. It is about having the teacher or the adult recognizing a student, meeting an expectation. So say, for example, the student is being respectful by raising their hand in the classroom. Instead of saying, or the teacher not acknowledging that appropriate behavior, which then may lead to a student not raising their hand, the teacher says, Jessica, thank you for being respectful. And we identify the behavior. So we state the expectation, we identify the behavior by raising your hand. It really means a lot to me that you're following, you know, the rules in our classroom. You're setting an example for your peers. And I just really appreciate that. Thank you so much. You make my job easier. It is about the connection. It's always been about the connection. But sometimes it's easier to put fluff and other stuff in the way than trying to make that connection. So I tell teachers and schools all the time, token economy, tangible, is appropriate for some students that do not have intrinsic skills. And maybe that's where you have to meet them at initially. But it's not, it's about the relationship. What are you doing to build a relationship with the student? How do you know that that student trusts you, right? How do you trust that student? Are you spending time with that student? That's what you have to do, because that's how we're hardwired. If you're going to have students earn things in a classroom, how do they earn more of your attention? How can they spend more time with you or other preferred adults? How can they, you know, sit in your desk and be the teacher for a certain amount of time? Non-monetary value, but something that supports and fosters that relationship. We look for magic bullets in education. And I think the extrinsic rewards in PBIS was a magic bullet that educators looked to say, oh yeah, well, this will do it. And then I don't have to do as much. No, you need to do as much. You just need to do it. And if you do it, it's going to pay off in the long run. And you don't need monetary things.
Can you also now apply that to the next level up? Administrators or leaders, as you wisely pointed out earlier, really the first step in creating a community of the school is to empower the adults. What are some practical sides of that in for any of our administrators who might be listening and wondering, you know, how do I do that? How do I bring those relational rewards to my staff so that we feel like we are a community?
Great question, Steve. For me as an administrator, I've been doing this for a long time now. And I've learned my most important lessons from my biggest mistakes, as we all do, I think, in leaders, because I don't think that we have systems that are really designed to prepare teachers for the classroom. And I also feel like we don't have systems in place to prepare leaders to be leaders, whether that be of a school or of a department. I think it's trial and error. You learn with boots on the ground and you learn from your biggest mistakes, unfortunately. But we know that we're wired for that relational aspect, human to human relationship. And we know that we're wired to please. Nobody goes into this profession wanting to fail students or fail their colleagues. So a principal needs to understand that to build that community of trust, how can you trust someone you don't know? And so how do you get to know your people first? And how do they get to know you? Because it has to go both ways. And so you have to truly be cognizant around what is the community that I serve, the bigger community of where maybe my school is placed. What is the community of my school or my department or my district for that matter? What are the needs? What are the strengths? And then really begin to be intentional about how you're going to go about that through a relational perspective, because you have to relate to be able to build those relationships that will foster, you know, regulation, will foster growth and be able to do those things. But it truly has to be about you have to know your people and they have to know you. So one of the first things that I did as a leader of a school was I needed to understand and get my pulse on my teachers. And I needed to know what made them tick and what made them explode. And I continue to do this every year. I do interest surveys. In education, we do interest surveys for our students all the time. What do you like? What do you prefer? Rarely do we do that to staff. I needed to know what my staff preferred. I still need to know what my staff prefer because our likes and dislikes change from year to year. What motivates you? What is that? Maybe it is just caffeine. Maybe it is just a ream of paper. Maybe it is right now motivation for you is to have an additional 15 minutes of a prep period. What do you like? And then I would begin to highlight those things in our staff meetings, in my, I still do this today. I do a monthly newsletter. And based on the interest surveys of my department, staff members are highlighted in the monthly newsletter, and I'm identifying their favorite books, their favorite movie, their favorite superhero, their favorite food, their favorite restaurant, their favorite thing that they do for their well-being. We highlight that and we share that out. And when I have a teacher that I know is really, really struggling, I need to know their interest so I know how to additionally motivate them to help them do the work. Because if they're motivated and they have the right motivation, they'll continue to do the work even when the work's hard. But if we don't know those basic things about our people, we may think that we're providing them that motivation because we're saying, good job, way to go, right? We walk through their classroom one moment in time. We do a formal evaluation on them twice a year. And we just say, keep up the good work. That is not motivation. I strongly believe you have to know your people. You have to know what makes them tick. You have to know what they like inside of school and outside of school. And then you can really begin to build that community and culture. But it starts with trust. And you can't have trust if you don't have relationships. You're completely compromised in doing all this really, really hard work if you don't have those two basic things.
Leilani, the other thing that you were talking about, the relational milieu and the expectations, is ensuring that you're doing it in a culturally relevant way. Right. And so I'm wondering if you can actually also talk about that of, you know, one of the challenges and one of the vulnerabilities is that education is highly white culture. It's founded in that. And so it can be very easy to set up a system and set up expectations that are actually not at all culturally relevant or appropriate for all the kids. How have you been able to do that? Because you have been in a lot of districts that are very diverse.
Absolutely. And the most important thing is that your community involves your parents. And if your parents aren't at the table and being an active part of the decisions, being an active part of those surveys, and then you're making decisions without that equity of input, then you're definitely shooting yourself in the foot. I'll go back to my first principal years here in Arizona. Our Hispanic Latino population are the majority of students in our school district. They're the majority. And then our Caucasian is right below that. But my Hispanic families were not responding to my surveys, my email communications, my phone calls. They weren't coming to our meetings that we were asking for feedback on our expectations. We would have students send home flyers, and we were just not connecting. They just weren't responding to us. My staff at that point really wanted to say, no, we just need to go. We just need to get this done. They don't want to participate. They don't want to participate. They had the opportunity. They're making a choice not to do that. How dare we assume that? How dare we assume that people are making an intentional choice without thinking of maybe they feel like they can't trust us to hear them. Maybe they don't have access to get here. Maybe, right, we need to be trying to communicate with them in a different way. So no, we aren't ever going to assume anything, because assumption doesn't do anything. And we do assumption enough and measure assumption in education enough as it is. So we have to be better than that. And so I knocked on doors. I found a few families begin to trust me enough to say, we have to hear from you because we have to do this right. Can you please help us? They started coming to our meetings. We started including more culturally responsive opportunities that really highlighted all of our different diverse cultures within our school, from our Hispanic population with our food nights, having those appropriate things, to our Native American population that had to come in off the reservation. That in itself is a huge thing, to have a family who has limited transportation come in. Their students get bused to us, but they don't have that opportunity to come to us. Well, why are we expecting them to come to us then? If we know that that is compromised, why aren't we going to them? So we go to them and we say, we want to hear you. We want to make sure that this is appropriate. Give us your feedback. What are your thoughts on this? It took a lot longer than we wanted, and it was worth the wait. Because then we could truly say all the voices were at the table. They've been heard. They've been validated. And we're taking all this information. And now we're really going to create an expectation system that honors this diversity. And our families can now begin to trust us that that is the case, that we did take those steps to do that. So I think that's imperative that you do that. Don't wait for them to come to you, and don't just assume. Go to them and figure it out. Don't move forward without it.
Y'all, go ahead and look at your clocks.
How did that happen?
I know. We didn't get to the big stuff that we wanted to talk about.
Sorry, I talked too much.
Oh, stop. This is the story of Grainer and I's lives. This happens every episode. So the big things, Leilani, I just love you said this earlier. We measure assumptions enough in schools.
We do.
Wow. And then practice is the practice is the practice. Because the thing, when I hear you saying all this, in particular about, you know, setting up a successful PBIS system or framework, sorry, a PBIS framework, is it takes time. This isn't something that you're throwing together in the beginning of the school year over the summer and using it in the fall. This takes a slow process to ensure that you're doing it. And to do it any other way is a disservice to the kids and will really continue to harm the marginalized. And well, to your word earlier in this episode, the undervalued kids.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It pays to slow down, to speed up. That's hard to do in an educational system because we feel like we have to go so fast because we're already so far behind.
The word that kept popping up to me, both at the beginning of our chat and at the end, was the word vulnerability, being that open door that is, it swings both ways. That, yeah, I'm going to the neighborhood vulnerable because I don't even know whose house I'm going to, but I'm going to make these connections. And by doing that, showing your vulnerability as a leader for the folks in your community seems incredibly important. And I'm guessing you felt that. And then I just make that as not a question, but then my last question to you is who takes care of you?
Well, you know, when you do the things that fulfill and align with your purpose. So I'm old enough now, I've been doing this a long time. So, you know, I'm intentional about aligning everything to my purpose and my values. And so when you do that, the work in itself is the care that you need. It's the reinforcement that I get from doing this work, even if it's, you know, not easy. I get my reinforcement from that because it aligns to my purpose and my values.
And of course, you like musicals. And so that makes us feel good.
And I really do like, and I've watched a few.
I was just going to ask, have you watched any of the musicals I assigned?
I love them.
Which one was your favorite?
So I watched, oh my gosh.
In the Heights.
Yes.
Okay. I was hoping you'd say that.
Yes. And then I went back and rewatched, cheesy as it is, Songland, believe it or not.
I don't know that.
Yeah.
Okay. Now I want to watch it.
And then I went and I did watch the new updated West Side Story. And you were right. I wasn't disappointed.
No, I watched it on the way home from Arizona when I saw you last.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, I did too.
I thought Jessica was going with Newsies all the way along, but I'm just throwing that out there.
Well, Newsies is a classic forever, but yes. A new West Side Story is beautiful. But Leilani, thank you for your time. I've had the privilege of knowing you and working with you for several years now. And every time I am with you and I am with your district and I see the teams that you create, there's a couple things that stand out to me. You're a phenomenal leader and you build teams that have high retention. And that's not something that you see every day in education. So what you are doing is working. And every time I'm with your team, I come back just rejuvenated and inspired. And so you're doing really good work.
Oh, thank you. They're a great team. I'm very lucky.
Yeah.
Very, very lucky.
And thank you for joining us today. This has been super insightful and it just means a lot that you gave us your time.
Okay. I can't wait for you to come back out here.
Done and done. All right. Thanks, Leilani.
Thank you for your time.
Hello, my name is Luce, the Lindbergh High School senior intern who edited today's episode. Education Suspended is a production of Intricate Roots and Educational Consulting Services. Our producer is Jessica Pfeiffer. Our Education Suspended website was created by Grainer Media. Our production manager is Gina Henson.